Welcome to episode 10 of the Over the Counter Podcast. I'm Mark Giestrick. In this particular podcast, where Andrew and I talk about the history and culture of restaurants, we'll actually be going back in time a little bit to before Over the Counter even had a name. And Andrew and I enjoyed our conversation in the sort of test pilot podcast so much that we thought we'd want to share it with you. So we hope you enjoy episode 10 of the Over the Counter Podcast.
Okay, welcome to a podcast which has no name yet.
We should probably do a check, though, right? Just see what this sounds like.
It looks like it's going to sound fine.
Okay.
Yeah. So my name is Mark Giestrick. I teach at the Augustine Institute in Denver, Colorado. Well, actually, probably speaking, Greenwood Village or something like that, south of Denver. And I'm with Andrew Whaley.
Hi.
And I'm actually sitting at the coffee bar that we have here in our little shop called Tole Lege, which supposedly means take up and read.
Exactly.
Okay. So, and the idea is that it's a coffee bar and bookshop, but we don't really sell that many books.
Not yet.
Well, you sell some books.
Write the vision down plainly on tablets, so all who see it may run to attain it. That's what the Bible says, right? Habakkuk 1.
Yeah, okay, sure.
1:6.
Okay, so the point is...
I'm Catholic. I don't know about scripture.
The point is that Andrew and I are here in our varying capacities. Me as scripture scholar, Andrew as what?
Coffee bar manager / philosopher king.
Right. Okay.
Yeah.
And so the point of this discussion, right, is we want to get into a few cultural issues and other things that we're not that we don't hear out there on the airwaves all the time. And the thing that we wanted to talk about today is restaurants.
Restaurants.
Now,
which is interesting because we're kind of in one. People just walked in.
This is the hospitality committee.
So the hospitality committee is on our podcast now. Hi, so I want to say hi to the hospitality committee.
All right. So the point of this, though, is that we're interested in restaurants. I was just reading about the history of restaurants. And restaurants are actually really new. Right, Andrew?
The shop?
No. Restaurants.
Monster restaurants. Restaurants as a concept, I don't know. I mean, how old are they? I mean,
1700s.
Really?
The first restaurant was like 1760-something.
That's like almost as old as the American experiment.
Right. Well, no. So restaurants came about largely because of the French Revolution. So this is, I mean, this gets...
So you didn't, I don't know. You told me about
this. I know.
This.
Well, this
gets
know. Really fascinating.
I don't know about this.
So it used to be the case, right? Everybody ate at home. If you didn't, if you were traveling, you stayed at an inn.
Right.
Right. And you could, or a tavern / inn, and you could eat there and then go sleep in your room. But there weren't restaurants like as we know them. So chefs, where do you think chefs live? Where do they work? They worked for rich people.
Oh.
Right? So if
so they're like the cooks.
Yeah. If you're
like on Downton Abbey.
If you're a professional chef, you don't work in a restaurant in the 1700s or before. You're working in the home of a wealthy duke or marquis or...
Right.
So, but what happened, though, during the French Revolution, right, is all of these French royalty types got executed or eliminated or
exiled. It's hard to have
exiled.
A chef when you don't have a head.
Right. And then so all the people who worked for them, right, were now unemployed.
Right.
So the personal private chef guys go and set up shop as restaurateurs, serving not the aristocrats, but the bourgeois.
See, this is fascinating, because this is kind of like, I just read an article about the birth of the barbershop, and it's really similar to this. These slaves would shave their masters, like, and they had everything for barbering and stuff like that, you know, and take care of them and cut their hair and stuff, and then the emancipation came around, or like they would go to the north or whatever, and they'd have these skills, and all these other people thought that this kind of work was beneath them, and so they took it up. And this new institution was born, and what was funny is that a real serious amount of wealth and prosperity came out of that new form of business that came out of this collapse of these old shackles and all that. So it's interesting that this is kind of, I wonder if there's like an overarching pattern that we could explore later with all this. So,
well, I think you're right, that there's an egalitarianism, right, that's born from the French Revolution that brings about a kind of restructuring, if you will. It doesn't exactly make sense. You've got bourgeois people, middle class types that are wanting some of the luxuries that the rich had, but maybe not on as regular of a basis, right? You're not going to go to a restaurant every day. You're not going to have a professional chef cooking for you every day, but maybe once a week, or maybe once a month, or maybe a few times a year.
Right.
You can enjoy the luxuries that a professional chef can provide.
And we're kind of, it seems like we're kind of living in, we're surrounded by the ashes of aristocracy, right? I mean, like, you're wearing a tie, right? It's like we used to have ties to hold the tops of our shirts together, and like the women's buttons are on the other side. If you ever seen a woman's dress shirt versus a men's dress shirt, because they used to have a maid servant to help them get dressed, and they're still made like that.
Right.
We still have like our buttons on our shirt and stuff are made with references. Like there's a little lapel this or whatever. There's there's things that reference a context we're no longer in.
Right.
And so that's fascinating.
So there's more to say about this restaurant thing.
Okay.
So before the birth of the restaurant, food that you could get at a tavern or an inn was very, very simple. Right, you could get meat and potatoes, bread, you know, beer, but nothing very fancy, right? Not complicated meals with many ingredients, because sauces hadn't really been invented yet.
Sauces?
So and this is really bizarre, but the birth of the restaurant goes along with the birth of bouillon.
This is so cool. I can't believe I didn't know about this stuff.
Well, yeah, I mean, I it is bizarre, but... But the idea...
The birth of bouillon?
Of bouillon.
Oh, yeah. Because you would take stock, you would make stock, and you would reduce it, and then you would dry it, and then you could have the peasant's protein, and all that collagen and gelatin and stuff in a powdered form, and then you could travel and have your own food with
it. Right. So early...
I've read about that,
restaurants were known by the kinds of bouillon that they used to make their soups and sauces. I mean, this is mainly happening in France, but of course, there's a lot of connection between the French Revolution and the American Revolution.
Right.
So you have this kind of back and forth across the Atlantic over all these kinds of cultural issues. So one of the things that was imported from Britain, from England, into America, was the concept of tipping.
Ah.
So it was something that was done by wealthy aristocrats in England. And some of them brought that custom over to the United States. So in a tavern or whatever, you would tip the barmaid or the waiter or whatever. And the original tip jars had an acronym on them, TIP. What do you think the acronym refers to?
Taking interest in persons. Spoken like a true Thomistic person.
Good guess. But no, the acronym TIP meant to ensure promptness. You'd have a jar on the counter or whatever that said TIP to ensure promptness, and that's where the concept of tipping comes from. The other thing that's really fascinating about it is that there are a lot of Americans, for example, the New York Times, way, way later, this is in 1897, decrying the practice of tipping. Why? Because it was creating an underclass of people who were dependent on the whims of the wealthy.
Well, that's still kind of the same.
Isn't that
right?
Fascinating, though? Because they viewed it in their democratic mindset, this is the 1800s, as unfair, right? Because you're basically determining these people's wage based on somebody's whim, not based on an agreed price.
Wow, it's funny, which is... It's still the case, but I look at it as someone who makes part of their income from tips and has, whether I was a fancy wine steward or I was just working at someone else's coffee house. Now, you know, I'm standing behind a bar that I run and I still make tips. And for me, I always liked it. It's the entrepreneurial aspect of working for someone else, because if you go out of your way, you do all the little things that you don't really have to do, and you're good at conversation, and you know how to stay out of the way, and when to get in the way, when you need to be in the way, then you get taken care of. And whenever I was working as a wine steward, the greatest honor you get was when someone on the way out shook your hand and you felt something in their hand, because they'd given you a personal tip besides what they put on the check, because we had to share those, and they would give you a personal, like, no, you took care of me. Right, so I went out of my way to try to do that. So that's so funny. It's like they would see that as a lowering of everyone, as a lowering of these people. But it still happens though. Yeah, you're if you work your tail off with a big table and they don't give you anything, then you're then you're left out, right? I mean, so that's the...
Well, right, so their
criticism of that still stands,
it's
right?
Not a contractual kind of arrangement, right? It's not like you're saying, I'm giving you this service and you're giving me this money. It's, it is based on somebody's will.
Right, but that's why I said it's entrepreneurial, because you have a chance to do something else. You have a chance to go beyond what you need to do and then get something for that. Because it's not contractual, but that's kind of like what the entrepreneurial endeavor is.
I think the hesitation on the part of the New York Times or whoever, right, about the concept of tipping would just be the idea of the bad wealthy people, right, that you were talking about, who might eat this elaborate meal and not leave a tip at all,
right?
Which would be wrong.
No, and it still happens
in our culture. It does happen.
I mean, all
but,
the time.
But you know, it's funny. I mean, I went to
and I China. Say to our shame, it happens more on Sunday mornings too.
Yeah. Well.
So if you're listening to this and you love God, because they talk bad about you and they try not to get your big table on Sunday mornings.
I went to China a few years ago. There's no tipping there at all. You don't tip the taxi cab driver. You don't tip the waiter, the waitress.
Right.
All the prices, everything's built in. And tipping is just not part of what goes on.
There's places in America that are going to that.
Yeah.
There are certain states and certain cities and stuff that are kind of outlawing tipping and building in a mandatory service charge.
Right.
And you know what? I just bumped into this in New York. I was in Manhattan this weekend, and I went to a restaurant. Tres Stella? No, it wasn't Tres Stella. Walker's, I think it was. Beautiful meal. Great French onion soup. But when it was just a couple of us, and when I got my bill, there was a 20% gratuity already built into the bill.
Wow.
The way there is for parties over 8 in a lot of restaurants. And it's just, they've just gotten to where it's like, look, we don't make money unless you tip.
Right.
So we're just going to make this standard. And then there was a part of me that was like, well, then just raise your prices and say no tipping.
Right.
You know?
But, well, that's basically what they did.
Right. So, but, I mean, so it's interesting that we're now trying to kind of level that, because the whim can be a little rough.
You know, I mean, but it reminds me a lot of other pricing schemes, like when you buy a ticket to fly on a plane nowadays. Right. Yeah, you get your ticket for the price you buy it for, but then if you want to bring a bag,
right,
that's an extra $25 each way. Right. So it really is a $50 surcharge.
Right. And I fly Frontier a lot.
Yeah.
And they just now started doing this in the last year, and now on January 1st they started charging for sodas, anything non-alcoholic beverages.
Right.
They don't give you any kind of peanuts.
Well, some airlines are going to start charging for carry-on bags that you put in the overhead bin. Yeah.
See, what they're trying to do, the problem is that we as consumers to a certain extent have driven them to that, because we buy completely on price with these comparison engines like Kayak and Hipmunk.
Right.
We look at just the price of the ticket, and they have to be able to compete on the level that these people aggregate,
so this is why,
which is the ticket
price.
This is
why a restaurant wouldn't do what you suggested. They're not going to raise their prices and then say no tipping. They're going to keep their prices low like everybody else and then just add on an automatic tip.
Right, and then if you go to the other extreme, it's like, it will throw in a completely second such and such a matic on the late night thing. Just pay separate for shipping and handling.
Yeah,
so that's all built into the overall package. You can't just buy one. You have to buy two, and you have to pay separate shipping and handling, even though they come in the same package.
Yeah.
It's like, so it's kind of the buy one, get one half off. I can say as a retailer for years, people, you can run a 25% off sale, and it'll draw some folks, but it's not overwhelming. You run a buy one, get one half off sale, and you'll have a line out your door.
Yeah.
But that's just a 25% off sale, and you're forcing them to buy two to get the deal. It's not as good a sale.
Right.
It's 25% off.
Right.
But people will line up for buy one, get one half off.
Yeah.
It's just it's mental, right?
It's just bizarre.
It's a perception thing.
So one of the other things, getting back to restaurants, one of the other things I wanted to say here, besides the fact that the first American restaurant was in Boston, opened by Jean-Baptiste Julien in 1793, the thing to get back to is this idea of private dining rooms.
Right.
I think you might have customers.
Maybe not. Just walking through. That's okay. That's why we're recording this in the cafe to capture. I'm kind of disappointed we haven't had some customers. I kind of wanted to capture the banter.
Okay, so,
you know,
so
this is the kind of conversation you have
now,
here.
I was looking for confirmation of this, but supposedly, before recent times, so before, say, 1900, whatever, most restaurants in the West, and Western Europe and the United States were constituted private, had private dining rooms, no public dining rooms.
Huh.
Okay.
I would love to see what that looks like from a layout level. What that, how that's laid
well,
out.
I've been to one of these, or more than one of these, in China. Right.
Oh.
So this is what's really interesting, is that supposedly it was considered immodest.
Right.
Or, I don't know, embarrassing or whatever, for people to watch you eat. And so you didn't want to do it. You didn't want to eat in public. Mm-hmm. You wanted to eat in private. So you would eat in your home, or you would eat in a private dining room at a restaurant, but not in a public dining room.
Hey, we have a customer. We get to capture the live romance of the cafe. I'm
okay, good. Well,
we're recording a podcast in the cafe.
Hopefully, he orders something really interesting.
Hi, Kevin Mallory, the guy who runs all of our video and graphics and stuff.
Am I live right now?
Not on the air. We're recording as we speak. It's good.
I was hoping for some coffee with you.
The Americana. We can do that. Do you like my emails?
I do. That made me crazy.
That's awesome.
Can I take one of these off your Instagram?
Absolutely. I'll put it on your chat.
The live romance of the cafe.
Yeah, well, we're in it right now.
Right, here we are, yeah. Hey, we may have to pause.
So,
we might have more romance than we can handle on the podcast. Yeah, I've got four pieces of romance. We might want to pause this.
All right. Well, okay, we'll pause it. We'll come back. Okay, so we're back from our pause now.
We can assert.
Yeah.
We can assert a commercial.
Right. Once Nike and Reebok are beating down our door to pay us millions of dollars for sponsorship opportunities, then we'll insert them during the service of customers moments in the podcast. I think your refrigerator door is open over there.
Oh, this part isn't cold.
Oh, okay.
So
never mind.
That's what matters.
Never mind. Okay, so we're talking about the history of restaurants.
Yes.
Right. 1793, the first restaurant in the United States in Boston, Julien. Okay, but in ancient Rome, they also had restaurants called Thermopolia. Okay, so it's like kind of like a snack bar or cafe. And
leave it to the Romans to invent the cafe.
Well, you know, I mean, if this were visual, I could show you a picture. Well, I can show you a picture, Andrew, but I can't show our listeners a picture. But they found a bunch of these in Pompeii, right? Mm-hmm. So one of those two cities that was destroyed by Vesuvius. It's kind of funny. It looks like basically a bunch of toilets.
That's crazy.
So it's basically like an L-shaped bar with a bunch of built-in bowl shapes in it. So they would put the food in those, I guess, and then you would kind of like...
And they found it.
Eat out of the bowls.
They know that's what it was because one guy was frozen.
Yeah, right.
Burned,
right.
Like with a knife and fork, and another guy had his hand out for a tip. Standing next to him.
So the point is that they did have these in ancient Rome, but... the Emperor Claudius actually shut them down for a while because there were marauding bands of gangster youth who were, you know, getting drunk at these Thermopolia and eating all this food and then going out in the streets and wreaking havoc. So he forbade the serving of food at the same place at which it was prepared. It's a really kind of tricky legislative way to destroy every restaurant around.
Oh, that's so weird.
Isn't that weird? So you could sell food, you could even sell prepared food, but you couldn't serve the food at the same place it was prepared.
So it was like takeout only.
Yeah, I guess.
It was like to go only.
Right.
They didn't want people hanging out and eating.
Right. So like after sunset, like you couldn't go out to a restaurant or drink or whatever.
Wow.
You could in your own home, right? But not at one of these public places.
What are they called?
Thermopolia.
Thermopolia.
So one of them would be a Thermopolium.
I was thinking like Thermopylae, if there's a connection. You're the Greek scholar here.
I don't think so. That's a city, right? Yeah.
Right.
A battle,
yeah.
A battle of Thermopylae.
For 300 and all that, right?
No, I don't think there's a connection there. I think it probably has something to do with the temperature of heating food.
That makes sense.
Now I have to do a word study on Thermopolium. Anyway.
You're a Greek scholar. You're griping about having to do a
Latin,
word study.
Right? This is Latin.
Well, I kind of read Latin.
All right, I'm looking it up on Wikipedia right now. Okay, so a Thermopolium, literally a place where something hot is sold.
Okay, there you go.
Okay, so the point of this is that dining has changed a lot. People eat out at restaurants a lot more now than used to, sure. Right? And there's a huge explosion of restaurants in our culture. Unfortunately, most of them are owned by these big chains and serve very standard food, whatever, you know. I don't know how to say it nicely. But it's radically different than the way dining used to be. And part of what dining used to be, it used to be about family, right? Yeah, it used to be about family, used to be about friends, used to be about eating together in community, and less about, what do you want to call it, consumerism?
Right.
It wasn't so much about I'm going, or me and my spouse are going to go eat a restaurant meal, or we're going to go eat a meal by a professional chef. It would more be wealthy aristocrats in France, right, inviting people into their house to eat food from their professional chef.
Right.
Or, in a later version, it would be eating in a private dining room with your friends as more of a community experience and less of a kind of atomistic, like, nuclear family-only experience.
Another question is, before the restaurant evolved into that, in all these cultures, though, there was street food, right?
Well,
there was,
of course, sure.
There's vendors.
Yeah.
Right, you could buy some noodles on the street.
Yeah, but that's different than fine dining, right? I mean, so right. even like the idea of the
no, I'm saying like, but the idea of food as an interaction of commerce around food in public was kind of going on, but it was more you grab it, you take it, and you hit walking down the street or whatever.
Sure.
Okay, so it's like coming to sit down.
Right. So this goes back to China though, which we were talking about a little bit before. In China, when you go to eat at a restaurant, a nice restaurant, all of the rooms are private.
Right, I want to see how that is.
There is no public dining room, so it's kind of like it almost feels like a hotel, right? So you go into the restaurant, and there's a hallway with a bunch of doors, and you and your friends go in through one of these doors into your own room that has a circular table, and there's also a kind of hierarchy of people who sit at the table, right? So there's one person who's like the host, who sits with his face to the door, so he's the one who kind of can communicate with the waiter who might peek in to see how things are going. He's also usually the one who picks up the tab.
Wow.
And then the seats to the right and left of him are sort of like guest of honor kind of seats.
So if they sit you down facing a door and you don't have your wallet on you,
yeah,
move.
Look out. Yeah. But it's usually sort of determined ahead of time.
Of course, yeah.
You know, at least to some extent.
Whoever made the reservation, it's made arrangements for this, right? Yeah.
And when you dine with the Chinese, there's a lot of drinking involved. They drink this horrible stuff called baijiu, which is basically like rice liquor.
So like soju, kind of?
Yeah, it's I mean, there are different levels of it, right? The cheap stuff is horrible.
Right.
The really expensive stuff's nice, but it's hard liquor. And but the so part of the ritual, right, is that you offer toasts, but not the way we do. So we offer toasts, and everybody at the whole table takes a drink, right? But for them, it's a kind of one-on-one thing a lot of the time.
Oh.
So you can do a whole table toast, but a lot of the time you say, you and I, Andrew, we're going to have a toast together. You and me, we'll drink together. Okay, and then you do that maybe with everybody at the table throughout the course of the meal.
Dude, I like that.
Yeah, it's really a kind of a more personal experience, I think.
But it's a personal experience in public, but which is ironically your public, in quotes, has been shut off from the rest of the public by this private room.
Right.
I'm fascinated by this. This is cool.
Well, and the idea of the circular table, I think, is beautiful in Chinese dining because unlike for us, where dining is a very individualistic experience, where you and I both sit down with menus and we decide what we want to eat, and then each one of us is served a different meal that we then eat at the same time,
right.
We're not actually sharing food. But in Chinese dining, the host is the one who's responsible for ordering.
Right.
So he orders all of the food, and the waiter comes in and puts it on a giant Lazy Susan in the middle of a circular table.
So this is basically, they're extending the experience that you would have had in an aristocrat's house in the West.
Yes.
Except they're outsourcing it to a new location.
Yes.
He is paying for, he is hosting, he is picking out the menu.
Right.
It's just not happening where he lives.
Right, well, and I mean, I don't know my Chinese history well enough to understand if this is how dining would have happened in a Chinese aristocratic situation,
right.
You know, in Imperial China 100, 200 years ago. I don't know, but probably.
But that's how it happens in the West. I mean, if you have someone over your house, you've picked out everything. Now, and we've normally cooked it as well.
Right.
But you set it all out. Now, what's interesting, though, is the modern kind of slow food movement, and a lot of foodies are into this, and some of the best restaurants will do this, and often at some of the best value, is there'll be a community table, like on Friday nights.
Yeah.
They'll have or Thursday nights, and you go pay a set price, and a big bunch of food comes out, and the wine comes around, and everyone sits and eats together, and you pay to be at the table and eat what's put before you.
Yeah, I don't know. I guess... But
it's a good time.
Well, I guess the thing about that though is it seems like such an artificial experience that you're like encountering these other people at the community table that you didn't come in with, right?
Like the populist.
I'm not necessarily saying it's bad.
The populist in downtown Denver, in Rhino and Larimer, a good chunk of their seating every night is at a communal table.
Well, I mean, I, it's probably a better experience, right, than going to Applebee's. You know, with your family and each person orders.
When you're going to run into people more interesting at the populist than you're going to run into Denny's too, right?
So. But I'm advocating the idea that the Chinese style of private dining is even better than that. But I wanted to say a couple more things about this, right? So beyond the idea of the host being the one who interacts with the waiter and the host being the one who orders the food and the host being the one who pays, he also is responsible in a certain sense for taking care of the guests, especially the guests of honor. So one of the things that they'll do is they'll pick out the sort of choicest portions of the food and put it on your plate with their own chopsticks, right? So everybody's pulling food off of these dishes on the Lazy Susan with their own chopsticks. But for the guest of honor, the host is often taking pieces of food and putting it on your plate for you.
Wow.
Right? And I mean, to me, that's just so beautiful. It's just such a more remarkable way to express the kind of communal fellowship that can happen in the context of a meal.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
It reminds me of this great quotation from C.S. Lewis about how the eating works both in heaven and in hell, and that both in heaven and hell, everybody has really long forks. And in hell, everybody's grabbing the end of the fork, and they can't feed themselves because their forks are too long. But in heaven, everybody's feeding the person across the table from them with that long fork. Which, I mean, it's just such a... I mean, C.S. Lewis just has a remarkable imagination to be able to come up with something like that. But it's such a beautiful depiction, right, of how it works, right, that there's this kind of selfishness that can drive us to starvation.
We should open a restaurant that is all private dining. It is called the Long Fork.
You have to feed the person across the table.
You'd have to have such good insurance because people would poke each other's eyes out.
I'm sure interesting things would happen. But I mean, that's, to me, like, the closest experience I've ever had to that has been in China. Right, with somebody placing food on my plate.
So you've been the guest of honor at one of these things.
Yes, I've experienced this.
And who was the host? Your brother? Or?
No, good friends that we met there.
China.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, see, I think that's fascinating. I think the idea of kind of like the shape of things, the shape of dining experiences or drinking experiences, kind of governing the conversation and the social interaction.
It's like the corner bar.
Right.
Right. Yeah. Like if everybody's sitting at a straight bar, then the only person they're really interacting with is probably the bartender or maybe the person to the right or the left.
Right.
But if you're at the corner of the bar,
right,
you can talk to maybe three or four people at the same time.
Right.
And have a better conversation. Which is why I think the best bars are the ones that have multiple corners.
Right. Well, you'll notice how I've kind of created this bar that we're sitting at, where I can, and the reason I did this is because I value, it's kind of like a, how would you say it, it's half of a, what's the shape with six sides, a hexagon?
A hexagon?
Yeah, it's like half of a hexagon, and the bar, and the machine sits in the middle, right? So the barista can interact with everybody on all sides. He also has a nice little cockpit for efficient working.
Sure.
But then you sitting here, you can pretty much see across and talk to everybody else at the bar the way this is shaped.
Yeah.
I've got an even better shape planned for my next project that I build. It's even going to be more interaction than that. So, and it's actually got a kind of an Asian influence too. So,
I mean, this has been a really fascinating conversation. I'm afraid we're actually going to have to draw it to a close. It's coming up on our time.
We're just getting to the good part.
I know, we're just getting warmed up, but this will be we'll have an even better discussion for our next podcast. But
all right.
I hope that this has been relatively enlightening in regards to the history of restaurants and how it is that our eating habits, our public eating habits, whatever they're called, have changed over time. And maybe how like some of the ideas that were present in those earlier forms or permutations of restaurants can maybe reemerge in a way that will be more human and more holistic. Or
maybe you're just a psychologist and you've always wondered what would happen if you put a scripture scholar and a coffee consultant with a degree in great books and philosophy
on a podcast at the same time. All right. Well, so long for today for our unnamed podcast, and we'll see you next time.
All right.